to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. Cardinal Baronius, repeated by Galileo during his trial. Why is there something rather than nothing? The unrest which keeps the never-stopping clock of metaphysics going is the thought that the non-existence of the world is just as possible as its existence. William James. The most beautiful experience we can have is the mysterious. It is the fundamental emotion which stands at the cradle of true art and true science. Whosoever does not know it and can no longer wonder, no longer marvel, is as good as dead, and his eyes are dimmed. Albert Einstein. In 1863, Thomas H. Huxley wrote, "The question of all questions for humanity, the problem which lies behind all others and is more interesting than any of them, is that of the determination of man's place in nature and his relation to the cosmos." Huxley was famous as Darwin's bulldog, the man who ferociously defended the theory of evolution to a deeply conservative Victorian England. English society saw humanity standing proudly at the very center of creation. Not only was the solar system the center of the universe, but humanity was the crowning achievement of God's creation, the pinnacle of God's divine handiwork. God had created us in his very image. By openly challenging this religious orthodoxy, Huxley had to defend Darwin's theory against the salvos launched by the religious establishment, thereby helping to establish a more scientific understanding of our role in the tree of life. Today, we recognize that among the giants of science, Newton, Einstein, and Darwin have done the yeoman's work in helping to define our rightful place in the cosmos. Each of them grappled with the theological and philosophical implications of his work in determining our role in the universe. In the conclusion to Principia, Newton declares, "The most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being." If Newton discovered the laws of motion, then there must be a divine lawgiver. Einstein, too, was convinced of the existence of what he called the Old One, but one who did not intervene in the affairs of men. His goal, instead of glorifying God, was to read the mind of God. He would say, "I want to know how God created this world. I am not interested in this phenomenon or that. I want to know God's thoughts. The rest are details." Einstein would justify his intense interest in these theological matters by concluding, "Science without religion is lame, but religion without science is blind." But Darwin was hopelessly divided on the question of the role of humanity in the universe. Although he is credited as the one who dethroned humanity from the center of the biological universe, he confessed in his autobiography concerning the extreme difficulty, or rather impossibility, of conceiving this immense and wonderful universe, including man, with his capacity for looking far backwards and far into futurity, as the result of blind chance or necessity. He confided to a friend, "My theology is simply a muddle." Unfortunately, the determination of man's place in nature and his relation to the cosmos has been fraught with danger, especially to those who dared to challenge the rigid dogma of the ruling orthodoxy. It was no accident that Nicolaus Copernicus wrote his pioneering book, De Revolutionibus Orbium Celestium, on the revolutions of the celestial orbs, on his deathbed in 1543, beyond the morbid reach of the Inquisition. It was also inevitable that Galileo, who had been protected for so long by his powerful patrons in the Medici family, would eventually suffer the wrath of the Vatican for popularizing an instrument that revealed a universe that so sharply contradicted church doctrine, the telescope. The mixture of science, religion, and philosophy is indeed a potent brew, so volatile that the great philosopher Giordano Bruno was burned at the stake in 1600 in the streets of Rome for refusing to repudiate his belief that there were an infinite number of planets in the heavens, harboring an infinite number of living beings. He wrote, "Thus is the excellence of God magnified and the greatness of his kingdom made manifest. He is glorified not in one, but in countless suns, not in a single earth, a single world, but in a thousand thousand, I say in an infinity of worlds." Galileo's and Bruno's sin was not that they dared to divine the laws of the heavens. Their true sin was that they dethroned humanity from its exalted place at the center of the universe. It would take over 350 years, until 1992, for the Vatican to issue a belated apology to Galileo. No apology was ever issued to Bruno. Historical perspective. Since Galileo, a series of revolutions have overturned our conception of the universe and our role in it. During the Middle Ages, the universe was seen as a dark, forbidding place. Earth was like a small, flat stage, full of corruption and sin, enclosed by a mysterious celestial sphere where omens like comets would terrify kings and peasants alike. And if we were deficient in our praise of God and church, we would face the wrath of the theater critics, the self-righteous members of the Inquisition and their hideous instruments of persuasion. Newton and Einstein freed us from the superstition and mysticism of the past. Newton gave us precise mechanical laws that guided all celestial bodies, including our own. The laws were so precise, in fact, that human beings became mere parrots reciting their lines. Einstein revolutionized how we viewed the stage of life. Not only was it impossible to define a uniform measure of time and space, the stage itself was curved. Not only was the stage replaced by a stretched rubber sheet, it was expanding as well. The quantum revolution gave us an even more bizarre picture of the world. On one hand, the downfall of determinism meant that the puppets were allowed to cut their strings and read their own lines. Free will was restored, but at the price of having multiple and uncertain outcomes. This meant that actors could be in two places at the same time and could disappear and reappear. It became impossible to tell for certain where an actor was on the stage or what time it was. Now, the concept of the multiverse has given us another paradigm shift, where the word universe itself could become obsolete. With the multiverse, there are parallel stages, one above the other, with trapdoors and hidden tunnels connecting them. Stages, in fact, give rise to other stages in a never-ending process of genesis. On each stage, new laws of physics emerge. On perhaps only a handful of these stages are the conditions for life and consciousness met. Today, we are actors living in Act One, at the beginning of the exploration of the cosmic wonders of this stage. In Act Two, if we don't destroy our planet through warfare or pollution, we may be able to leave Earth and explore the stars and other heavenly bodies. But we are now becoming aware that there is the final scene, Act Three, when the play ends and all the actors perish. In Act Three, the stage becomes so cold that life becomes impossible. The only possible salvation is to leave the stage entirely via a trapdoor and start over again with a new play and a new stage. Copernican Principle versus Anthropic Principle. Clearly, in the transition from the mysticism of the Middle Ages to the quantum physics of today, our role, our place in the universe, has shifted dramatically with each scientific revolution. Our world has been expanding exponentially, forcing us to change our conception of ourselves. When I view this historic progression, I am sometimes overwhelmed by two contradictory emotions, as I gaze upon the seemingly limitless number of stars in the celestial firmament, or contemplate the myriad forms of life on Earth. On one hand, I feel dwarfed by the immensity of the universe. When contemplating the vast, empty expanse of the universe, Blaise Pascal once wrote, "The eternal silence of those infinite spaces strikes me with terror." On the other hand, I cannot help but be mesmerized by the splendid diversity of life and the exquisite complexity of our biological existence. Today, when approaching the question of scientifically ascertaining our role in the universe, there are, in some sense, two extreme philosophical points of view represented in the physics community: the Copernican principle and the Anthropic principle. The Copernican principle states that there is nothing special about our place in the universe. Some wags have dubbed this the mediocrity principle. So far, every astronomical discovery seems to vindicate this point of view. Not only did Copernicus banish Earth from the center of the universe, Hubble displaced the entire Milky Way galaxy from the center of the universe, giving us instead an expanding universe of billions of galaxies. The recent discovery of dark matter and dark energy underscores the fact that the higher chemical elements that make up our bodies comprise only 0.03% of the total matter-energy content of the universe. With the inflation theory, we must contemplate the fact that the visible universe is like a grain of sand embedded in a much larger, flat universe, and that this universe itself may be constantly sprouting new universes. And finally, if M-theory proves successful, we must face the possibility that even the familiar dimensionality of space and time must be expanded to 11 dimensions. Not only have we been banished from the center of the universe, we may find that even the visible universe is but a tiny fraction of a much larger multiverse. Faced with the enormity of this realization, one is reminded of the poem by Stephen Crane, who once wrote, "A man said to the universe, 'Sir, I exist.' 'However,' replied the universe, 'the fact has not created in me a sense of obligation.'" One is reminded of Douglas Adams's science fiction spoof, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, in which there is a device called the Total Perspective Vortex, which is guaranteed to transform any sane person into a raving lunatic. Inside the chamber is a map of the entire universe with a tiny arrow reading, "You are here." But at the other extreme, we have the Anthropic principle, which makes us realize that a miraculous set of accidents makes consciousness possible in this three-dimensional universe of ours. There is a ridiculously narrow band of parameters that makes intelligent life a reality, and we happen to thrive in this band. The stability of the proton, the size of the stars, the existence of higher elements, and so on, all seem to be finely tuned to allow for complex forms of life and consciousness. One can debate whether this fortuitous circumstance is one of design or accident, but no one can dispute the intricate tuning necessary to make us possible. Stephen Hawking remarks, "If the rate of expansion 1 second after the Big Bang had been smaller by even one part in 100,000 million, the universe would have recollapsed before it reached its present size. The odds against a universe like ours emerging out of something like the Big Bang are enormous. I think there are clearly religious implications." We often fail to appreciate how precious life and consciousness really are. We forget that something as simple as liquid water is one of the most precious substances in the universe, that only Earth, and perhaps Europa, a moon of Jupiter, has liquid water in any quantity in the solar system, perhaps even in this sector of the galaxy. It is also likely that the human brain is the most complex object nature has created in the solar system, perhaps out to the nearest star. When we view the vivid pictures of the lifeless terrain of Mars or Venus, we are struck by the fact that those surfaces are totally barren of cities and lights or even the complex organic chemicals of life. Countless worlds exist in deep space, devoid of life, much less of intelligence. It should make us appreciate how delicate life is and what a miracle it is that it flourishes on Earth. The Copernican principle and the anthropic principle are in some sense opposite perspectives which bracket the extremes of our existence and help us to understand our true role in the universe. While the Copernican principle forces us to confront the sheer enormity of the universe and, perhaps, the multiverse, the anthropic principle forces us to realize how rare life and consciousness really are. But ultimately, the debate between the Copernican principle and the anthropic principle cannot determine our role in the universe unless we view this question from an even larger perspective, from the point of view of the quantum theory. Quantum meaning. The world of quantum science sheds much light on the question of our role in the universe, but from a different point of view. If one subscribes to the Wigner interpretation of the Schrödinger cat problem, then we necessarily see the hand of consciousness everywhere. The infinite chain of observers, each one viewing the previous observer, ultimately leads to a cosmic observer, perhaps God himself. In this picture, the universe exists because there is a deity to observe it. And if Wheeler's interpretation is correct, then the entire universe is dominated by consciousness and information. In this picture, consciousness is the dominant force that determines the nature of existence. Wigner's viewpoint, in turn, led Ronnie Knox to pen the following poem about an encounter between a skeptic and God, pondering if a tree exists in the courtyard when there is no one there to observe it. There was once a man who said, "God must think it exceedingly odd if he finds that this tree continues to be when there's no one about in the quad." An anonymous wag then penned the following reply. "Dear sir, your astonishment's odd. I am always about in the quad, and that's why the tree will continue to be, since observed by yours faithfully, God." In other words, trees exist in the courtyard because a quantum observer is always there to collapse the wave function, God himself. Wigner's interpretation puts the question of consciousness at the very center of the foundation of physics. He echoes the words of the great astronomer James Jeans, who once wrote, 50 years ago, the universe was generally looked on as a machine. When we pass to extremes of size in either direction, whether to the cosmos as a whole or to the inner recesses of the atom, the mechanical interpretation of nature fails. We come to entities and phenomena which are in no sense mechanical. To me, they seem less suggestive of mechanical than of mental processes. The universe seems to be nearer to a great thought than to a great machine. This interpretation takes perhaps its most ambitious form in Wheeler's theory of it from bit. It is not only that we are adapted to the universe is also adapted to us. In other words, in some sense, we create our own reality by making observations. He calls this genesis by observership. Wheeler claims that we live in a participatory universe. These same words are echoed by Nobel laureate biologist George Wald, who wrote, "It would be a poor thing to be an atom in a universe without physicists, and physicists are made of atoms. A physicist is the atom's way of knowing about atoms." Unitarian minister Gary Kowalski summarizes this belief by saying, "The universe, it could be said, exists to celebrate itself and revel in its own beauty. And if the human race is one facet of the cosmos growing toward awareness of itself, our purpose must surely be to preserve and perpetuate our world as well as to study it, not to despoil or destroy what has taken so long to produce." In this line of reasoning, the universe does have a point. To produce sentient creatures like us who can observe it so that it exists. According to this perspective, the very existence of the universe depends on its ability to create intelligent creatures who can observe it, and hence collapse its wave function. One may take comfort in the Wigner interpretation of the quantum theory. However, there is the alternate interpretation, the many-worlds interpretation, which gives us an entirely different conception of the role of humanity in the universe. In the many-worlds interpretations, Schrödinger's cat can be both dead and alive simultaneously, simply because the universe itself has split into two separate universes. Meaning in the multiverse. It is easy to get lost in the infinite multitude of universes in the many-worlds theory. The moral implications of these parallel quantum universes are explored in a short story by Larry Niven, All the Myriad Ways. In the story, Detective Lieutenant Gene Trimble investigates a rash of mysterious suicides. Suddenly, all over town, people with no previous history of mental problems are jumping off bridges, blowing their brains out, or even committing mass murder. The mystery deepens when Ambrose Harmon, the billionaire founder of the Crosstime Corporation, jumps off the 36th floor of his luxury apartment after winning $500 at a poker table. Rich, powerful, and well-connected, he had everything to live for. His suicide makes no sense. But Trimble eventually discovers a pattern. 20% of the pilots of the Crosstime Corporation have committed suicide. Indeed, the suicides started a month after the founding of Crosstime. Digging deeper, he finds that Harmon had inherited his vast fortune from his grandparents and squandered it backing harebrained causes. He might have lost his entire fortune, but for one gamble that paid off. He had assembled a handful of physicists, engineers, and philosophers to investigate the possibility of parallel time tracks. Eventually, they devised a vehicle that could enter a new timeline, and the pilot promptly brought back a new invention from the Confederate States of America. Crosstime then bankrolled hundreds of missions to parallel timelines, where they would discover new inventions that could be brought back and patented. Soon, Crosstime became a billion-dollar corporation, holding the patents to the most important world-class inventions of our time. It looked as if Crosstime would be the most successful corporation of its age, with Harmon in charge. Each timeline, they found, was different. They found the Catholic Empire, Amerindian America, Imperial Russia, and scores of dead, radioactive worlds that had ended in nuclear war. But eventually, they find something deeply disturbing. Carbon copies of themselves, living lives almost identical to their own, but with a bizarre twist. In these worlds, no matter what they do, anything can happen. No matter how hard they work, they might realize their most fantastic dreams or live through their most wrenching nightmare. Whatever they do, in some universes they are successful, and in others they are complete failures. No matter what they do, there are an infinite number of copies of themselves who make the opposite decision and reap all possible consequences. Why not become a bank robber if, in some universe, you will walk away scot-free? Trimble thinks, there was no luck anywhere. Every decision was made both ways. For every wise choice you bled your heart out over, you made all the other choices, too. And so it went, all through history. Profound despair overwhelms Trimble as he reaches a soul-wrenching realization. In a universe where everything is possible, nothing makes any moral sense. He falls victim to despair, realizing that we ultimately have no control over our fates, that no matter what decision we make, the outcome does not matter. Eventually, he decides to follow Harmon's lead. He pulls out a gun and points it at his head. But even as he pulls the trigger, There are an infinite number of universes in which the gun misfires, the bullet hits the ceiling, the bullet kills the detective, and so on. Trimble's ultimate decision is played out in an infinite number of ways in an infinite number of universes. When we imagine the quantum multiverse, we are faced, as Trimble is in the story, with the possibility that, although our parallel selves living in different quantum universes may have precisely the same genetic code, at crucial junctures of life, our opportunities, our mentors, and our dreams may lead us down different paths, leading to different life histories and different destinies. One form of this dilemma is actually almost upon us. It's only a matter of time, perhaps a few decades, before the genetic cloning of humans becomes an ordinary fact of life. Although cloning a human being is extremely difficult, in fact, no one has yet fully cloned a primate, let alone a human, and the ethical questions are profoundly disturbing, it is inevitable that at some point it will happen. And when it does, the question arises, do our clones have a soul? Are we responsible for our clones' actions? In a quantum universe, we would have an infinite number of quantum clones. Since some of our quantum clones might perform acts of evil, are we then responsible for them? Does our soul suffer for the transgressions of our quantum clones? There is a resolution to this quantum existential crisis. If we glance across the multiverse of infinite worlds, we may be overwhelmed by the dizzying randomness of fate. But within each world, the common-sense rules of causality still hold in the main. In the multiverse theory proposed by physicists, each distinct universe obeys Newtonian-like laws on the macroscopic scale, so we can live our lives comfortably, knowing that our actions have largely predictable consequences. Within each universe, the laws of causality, on average, rigidly apply. In each universe, if we commit a crime, then most likely we will go to jail. We can conduct our affairs blissfully unaware of all the parallel realities that coexist with us. It reminds me of the apocryphal story that physicists sometimes tell each other. One day, a physicist from Russia was brought to Las Vegas. He was dazzled by all the capitalist opulence and debauchery that Sin City had to offer. He went immediately to the gaming tables and placed all his money on the first bet. When he was told that this was a silly gambling strategy, that his strategy flew in the face of the laws of mathematics and probability, he replied, "Yes, all that is true, but in one quantum universe I shall be rich." The Russian physicist may have been correct, and in some parallel world may be enjoying wealth beyond his imagination. But in this particular universe, he lost and left dead broke, and he must suffer the consequences. What physicists think about the meaning of the universe. The debate on the meaning of life was stirred even more by Steven Weinberg's provocative statements in his book, The First 3 Minutes. He writes, "The more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it also seems pointless. The effort to understand the universe is one of the very few things that lifts human life a little above the level of farce and gives it some of the grace of tragedy." Weinberg has confessed that of all the sentences he has written, this one elicited the most heated response. He later created another controversy with his comment, "With or without religion, good people can behave well and bad people can do evil. But for good people to do evil, that takes religion." Weinberg apparently takes a certain devilish delight in stirring up the pot, poking fun at the pretensions of those who profess some insight into the cosmic meaning of the universe. "For many years I have been a cheerful Philistine in philosophical matters," he confesses. Like Shakespeare, he believes that all the world is a stage. "But the tragedy is not in the script. The tragedy is that there is no script." Weinberg mirrors the words of fellow scientist Richard Dawkins of Oxford, a biologist who proclaims, In a universe of blind physical forces, some people are going to get hurt, and other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. In essence, Weinberg is laying down a challenge. If people believe that the universe has a point, then what is it? When astronomers peer out into the vastness of the cosmos, with giant stars much larger than our sun being born and dying in a universe that has been explosively expanding for billions of years, it is hard to see how all this could have been precisely arranged to give a purpose to humanity dwelling on a tiny planet revolving around an obscure star. Although his statements have generated much heat, very few scientists have risen to confront them. Yet when Alan Lightman and Roberta Brar interviewed a collection of prominent cosmologists to ask them if they agreed with Weinberg, interestingly, only a handful accepted Weinberg's rather bleak assessment of the universe. One scientist who was firmly in Weinberg's camp was Sandra Faber of the Lick Observatory and the University of California at Santa Cruz, who said, "I don't believe the Earth was created for people. It was a planet created by natural processes, and as part of the further continuation of those natural processes, life and intelligent life appeared. In exactly the same way, I think the universe was created out of some natural process, and our appearance in it was a totally natural result of physical laws in our particular portion of it. Implicit in the question, I think, is that there's some motive power that has a purpose beyond human existence. I don't believe in that. So I guess, ultimately, I agree with Weinberg that it's completely pointless from a human perspective." But a much larger camp of cosmologists thought Weinberg was off base, that the universe did have a point, even if they could not articulate it. Margaret Geller, a professor at Harvard University, said, "I guess my view of life is that you live your life, and it's short. The thing is to have as rich an experience as you possibly can. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to do something creative. I try to educate people." And a handful of them did indeed see a point to the universe in the handiwork of God. Don Page of the University of Alberta, a former student of Stephen Hawking, said, "Yes, I would say there's definitely a purpose. I don't know what all the purposes are, but I think one of them was for God to create man to have fellowship with God. A bigger purpose, maybe, was that God's creation would glorify God." He sees the handiwork of God even in the abstract rules of quantum physics. In some sense, the physical laws seem to be analogous to the grammar and the language that God chose to use. Charles Meisner of the University of Maryland, one of the early pioneers in analyzing Einstein's general relativity theory, finds common ground with Page. "My feeling is that in religion there are very serious things, like the existence of God and the brotherhood of man, that are serious truths that we will one day learn to appreciate in perhaps a different language on a different scale. So I think there are real truths there, and in the sense the majesty of the universe is meaningful, and we do owe honor and awe to its creator." The question of the creator raises the question, can science say anything about the existence of God? The theologian Paul Tillich once said that physicists are the only scientists who can say the word God and not blush. Indeed, physicists stand alone among scientists in tackling one of humanity's greatest questions. Is there a grand design? And if so, is there a designer? Which is the true path to truth, reason or revelation? String theory allows us to view the subatomic particles as notes on a vibrating string. The laws of chemistry correspond to the melodies one can play on these strings. The laws of physics correspond to the laws of harmony that govern these strings. The universe is a symphony of strings, and the mind of God can be viewed as cosmic music vibrating through hyperspace. If this analogy is valid, one must ask the next question. Is there a composer? Did someone design the theory to allow for the richness of possible universes that we see in string theory? If the universe is like a finely tuned watch, is there a watchmaker? In this sense, string theory sheds some light on the question, did God have a choice? Whenever Einstein was creating his cosmic theories, he would always ask the question, how would I have designed the universe? He leaned toward the idea that perhaps God had no choice in the matter. String theory seems to vindicate this approach. When we combine relativity with the quantum theory, we find theories that are riddled with hidden but fatal flaws, divergences that blow up and anomalies that spoil the symmetries of the theory. Only by incorporating powerful symmetries can these divergences and anomalies be eliminated, and M-theory possesses the most powerful of these symmetries. Thus, perhaps, there might be a single, unique theory that obeys all the postulates that we demand in a theory. Einstein, who often wrote at length about the Old One, was asked about the existence of God. To him, there were two types of gods. The first God was the personal God, the God who answered prayers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Moses, the God that parts the waters and performs miracles. However, this is not the God that most scientists necessarily believe in. Einstein once wrote that he believed in Spinoza's God, who reveals himself in the orderly harmony of what exists, not in a God who concerns himself with fates and actions of human beings. The God of Spinoza and Einstein is the God of harmony, the God of reason and logic. Einstein writes, I cannot imagine a God who rewards and punishes the objects of his creation. Neither can I believe that the individual survives the death of his body. In Dante's Inferno, the first circle near the entrance to hell is populated by people of goodwill and temperament who failed to fully embrace Jesus Christ. In the first circle, Dante found Plato and Aristotle and other great thinkers and luminaries. As physicist Wilczek remarks, we suspect that many, perhaps most, modern scientists will find their way to the first circle. Mark Twain might also be found in that illustrious first circle. Twain once defined faith as believing what any darn fool knows ain't so. Personally, from a purely scientific point of view, I think that perhaps the strongest argument for the existence of the God of Einstein or Spinoza comes from teleology. If string theory is eventually experimentally confirmed as the theory of everything, then we must ask where the equations themselves come from. If the unified field theory is truly unique, as Einstein believed, then we must ask where this uniqueness came from. Physicists who believe in this God believe that the universe is so beautiful and simple that its ultimate laws could not have been an accident. The universe could have been totally random or made up of lifeless electrons and neutrinos incapable of creating any life, let alone intelligent life. If, as I and some other physicists believe, the ultimate laws of reality will be described by a formula perhaps no more than 1 inch long, then the question is, where did this equation come from? As Martin Gardner has said, why does the apple fall? Because of the law of gravitation. Why the law of gravitation? Because of certain equations that are part of the theory of relativity. Should physicists succeed someday in writing one ultimate equation from which all physical laws can be derived, one could still ask, why that equation? Creating our own meaning. Ultimately, I believe the very existence of a single equation that can describe the entire universe in an orderly, harmonious fashion implies a design of some sort. However, I do not believe that this design gives personal meaning to humanity. no matter how dazzling or elegant the final formulation of physics may be, it will not uplift the spirits of billions and give them emotional fulfillment. No magic formula coming from cosmology and physics will enthrall the masses and enrich their spiritual lives. For me, the real meaning in life is that we create our own meaning. It is our destiny to carve out our own future rather than have it handed down from some higher authority. Einstein once confessed that he was powerless to give comfort to the hundreds of well-meaning individuals who wrote stacks of letters pleading with him to reveal the meaning of life. As Alan Guth has said, "It's okay to ask those questions, but one should not expect to get a wiser answer from a physicist. My own emotional feeling is that life has a purpose. Ultimately, I'd guess that the purpose it has is the purpose that we've given it, and not a purpose that came out of any cosmic design." I believe that Sigmund Freud, with all his speculations about the dark side of the unconscious mind, came closest to the truth when he said that what gives stability and meaning to our minds is work and love. Work helps to give us a sense of responsibility and purpose, a concrete focus to our labors and dreams. Work not only gives discipline and structure to our lives, it also provides us with a sense of pride, accomplishment, and a framework for fulfillment. And love is an essential ingredient that puts us within the fabric of society. Without love, we are lost, empty, without roots. We become drifters in our own land, unattached to the concerns of others. Beyond work and love, I would add two other ingredients that give meaning to life. First, to fulfill whatever talents we are born with. However blessed we are by fate with different abilities and strengths, we should try to develop them to the fullest, rather than allow them to atrophy and decay. We all know individuals who did not fulfill the promise they showed in childhood. Many of them became haunted by the image of what they might have become. Instead of blaming fate, I think we should accept ourselves as we are and try to fulfill whatever dreams are within our capability. Second, we should try to leave the world a better place than when we entered it. As individuals, we can make a difference, whether it is to probe the secrets of nature, to clean up the environment and work for peace and social justice, or to nurture the inquisitive, vibrant spirit of the young by being a mentor and a guide. Transition to Type 1 Civilization. In Anton Chekhov's play Three Sisters, in Act 2, Colonel Vershinin proclaims, "In a century or two, or in a millennium, people will live in a new way, a happier way. We won't be there to see it, but it's why we live, why we work. It's why we suffer. We're creating it. That's the purpose of our existence. The only happiness we can know is to work toward that goal." Personally, rather than be depressed by the sheer enormity of the universe, I am thrilled by the idea of entirely new worlds that exist next to ours. We live in an age when we are just beginning the exploration of the cosmos with our space probes and space telescopes, our theories and equations. I also feel privileged to be alive at a time when our world is undergoing such heroic strides. We are alive to witness perhaps the greatest transition in human history, the transition to a Type 1 civilization, perhaps the most momentous but also dangerous transition in human history. In the past, our ancestors lived in a harsh, unforgiving world. For most of human history, people lived short, brutish lives, with an average life expectancy of about 20 years. They lived in constant fear of diseases, at the mercy of the fates. Examination of the bones of our ancestors reveals that they are incredibly worn down, a testament to the heavy loads and burdens they carried daily. They also bear the telltale marks of disease and horrible accidents. Even within the last century, our grandparents lived without the benefit of modern sanitation, antibiotics, jet airplanes, computers, or other electronic marvels. Our grandchildren, however, will live at the dawning of Earth's first planetary civilization. If we don't allow our often brutal instinct for self-destruction to consume us, our grandchildren could live in an age where want, hunger, and disease no longer haunt our destiny. For the first